Magyanatimirandasyajinam janashalakaya Chakshudanmilitam yenatashmi shri kudabhin namah Namashrishtam manumapi satchiputram matrasharupam Rupam tasyagrajamuru purim maturim goshtavutam Radhakundam girivaram maho radhikamadhavasam Prapto yasya pratita kripaya shri gurum tam natushme Vancha kalpataru vyasya kripa sindhu vyai vacham Patitanam pavani vyu vaishnavibhya namo namah Nikila shruti mali ratnamala dyuti Nirajita pada panka janta Aji mukta kulai rupashyamanam paritashtram harinam samsrayami Anare pita chanim chirat karunayabatirna kalam Chamar paitumunna tochvalarasam sabhakti shriyam Hari purata sundara dyuti kadamba sandi pitam Sadahridaye kandaresh purato vasachinandana Janulambita bujo kanakabadatu Sankirtanai kapitaru kamalaya takshu Vishwambaro dhiyabaro jugadharma palu Vande jagat priyakuro karunavataru He Krishna karuna sindhu dinabandho jagatpate Gopesha gopika kantaradha kantanamostute Radhe Vrindavanadi Shri Karunamrita Vahini Kripayani Jabadabja Dasyan Mahim Pradiyatam Bhaktya Bhinaya Paradha Lakshay Kriptas Chakamadita Rangamadhyay Kripa Maitvam Sharanam Prapanam Brinde Namaste Charanaravindam Brinde Namaste Charanaravindam Shri Shri Gaudiya Vaishnav Guru Parampara Ki Jai Shri Hari Nam Sankirtan Ki Jai Shri Shri Purnityananda Ki Jai Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bo So, pranam to all of you. Thanks for coming. Welcome. Thanks so much again for the invitation to spend some days with all of you here in Keti Keti, Kati Kati, how to pronounce it? That's still a paradox for me. Okay. Kati Kati. I like to relate more with Tauranga. It's closer to Gauranga. So, whatever the case, here we are. Very auspicious land and environment. So, thank you so much for giving me the blessing of your time. As I always like to say, despite risk and redundance, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that his time personified, right? His time. So you are giving me your time now, which means you are giving me Krishna. Whose time? So you are giving me Krishna. So that's what follows from now is my attempt to reciprocate with your giving me Krishna. Hopefully I can give something back of the same value. By his grace, we can be instruments for so many wonderful things, and that's in itself so humbling, so moving. So as Ramachandra Prabhu was mentioning, the idea, at least for our morning gatherings, which will be three of them, since I have some other engagements and in the other mornings, we'll be trying to share about on the Shikshastakam and the third verse of the Shikshastakam. In the evenings we'll have questions and answers, or as I like to quote it, call it not Q&A but Q&E, quest and explorations. No, I'm not here to just give answers, but to explore together. So that will be in the evenings, on whatever topic you may like to bring. But yeah, in the morning today, in 2 days, and then in 2 days after, I felt some inspiration to explore the third verse of Shikshastakam, which, in my opinion, for many reasons, as we will try to make, is the most important. Not only the most important instruction for us, for most of us, but in one sense, the most important thing that has been ever said by Mahaprabhu, and therefore something to keep in mind, to say the least. So we'll try to unpack the implications of these small four lines, which seem to be just like very little, and so much is there. Everything is there. So today I'd like to make some introduction to this third verse, some ideas about the general meaning of the verse, and maybe in the next meeting, trying to go line by line, trying to unpack what it means, each one of those qualities that Mahaprabhu is mentioning. And then our last gathering, I'd like to address the third verse of Shikshastakam through the lenses of unconditional love, which is a topic I like to talk about a lot. And I think that we need to hear a lot about how we are being unconditionally loved and accepted by Krishna, and how the third verse can be embraced and understood from that perspective in a very healthy and even healing way. So let's begin with some, historical backgrounds, a little bit on the Shikshastakam, on the third verse of Shikshastakam, and on the author of this verse, which is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, the deity of our Gaudiya Sampradaya, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Ki Jai. So it happens that with Mahaprabhu, very similar to many other great teachers from other wisdom traditions, like Jesus or like Buddha or like even Socrates, they didn't leave much written legacy. No, it was more how they walked their talk, which at the end of the day is the most important thing. They shared teachings, but they shared a living example, a living walking of their talking. That's it. There are a few verses that have been ascribed to Mahaprabhu, which are what we call as Shikshashtakam. There are a few other verses, also two more. This famous verse, Naham Bipro, Nachanara, Patir, I'm not Brahman, I'm not sure. That's one of those, and another one. But Shikshashtakam is kind of the most well-known words attributed to Mahaprabhu. So first, the Shikshastakam appears in Rupa Goswami's compilation of verses called Padyavali. But here, these eight verses do not appear in sequence. This is appear scattered throughout the work in no particular order. So there are these eight verses attributed to Sri Chaitanya. So that's the first place where we meet, where we find the Shikshastakam. And then we find the eight verses in a particular sequence in Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami's Chaitanya Charitamrita. The very last chapter of Chaitanya Charitamrita is called Shikshastakam. That's very interesting. And then the Gaur Lila concludes in Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami's narrative. Then after that, we find personalities like Sri Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who will take these eight verses and start to explain them as indicating the different stages in the bhakti journey. In books like Bhajan Rahasya or others, he will point how each one of these eight verses speak about the stages from Shraddha to Prem. We won't go this time in that direction. Again, there's so much to explore, but he will make this case. First verse, just quickly mentioned, just for the nerds present here who want to take notes. I'm one of those, just in case. So verse 1 speaks, he will say about Shraddha and Sadhu Sangha. Verse 2 about Anartan Bhajana Kriya and Anartani Vritti. Verse 3 about Nishta. Verse 4 about Ruchi. Verse 5 about Asakti. Verse 6 about Bhava. And verse 7 and 8 about Prem. Verse 7 about Prem, Vipralamba Prem, divine love in separation. Verse 8 about Sambhog Prem, verse divine love in union. So, and also he will mention the first verse of Shikshastakam, the longest one, Chetu Dharpana Marjanam, so kind of includes all these stages. And the glories mentioned, the seven glories mentioned in the first verse are unpacked in the remaining seven verses of the Shikshastakam. And after Bhaktivinoda Thakur, we have different Gaudiya Vaishnava authors explaining the Shikshastakam. So gradually this tradition of the Shikshastakam as central to our tradition was growing in time. And in many ashrams nowadays around the world, at least that has been my experience when I joined the ashram 25 years ago, Shikshastakam was there every as part of our morning program. Maybe it was your case as well. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's an important part of our life, of our day. It should. That said, Sikshastakam. Now we're going to the third verse of Sikshastakam. This third verse has received special attention. In fact, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, where the first place where we find the Sikshastakam in sequence, the third verse is the one which appeared the most throughout the book. It not only appears when the eight verses are given, but it appears two more times before, which none of the other eight verses appeared that much. So that's a way of saying, hey guys, pay attention to this. This is important. So I'll briefly mention where we find this verse and in which context. All of this starts to build up about the importance of the verse. So the first time we find it in the 17th chapter of the Adi Lila, and there Mahaprabhu is talking to Suklambar Brahmachari. And he's giving kind of his final instruction to him. And his final instruction is this third verse, which of course, you know, Trinadapi Sunichena, Tarori Vasa Krishna, Manina Manadena, Kirtaniya Sadahari. And then Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, he says, after paraphrasing Mahaprabhu, speaking that verse to Suklambar Brahmachari, says, raising my hands, I now will say something very loudly. Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says that. So you can imagine an author writing a book and he himself writing, now I'm raising my hands. I will say something very loudly, like implying, you audience, pay attention to this. So he says, try to put this verse and, how do you say in English? The Spanish word comes, like weave it in through the thread of the holy name, basically, and wear it around your neck like a garland. No? And he's saying that, like, again, hands raised and shouting in full volume, like making a point, this is a very important verse, try to garland yourself with this verse. Garlanding is like a decoration, like an ornamentation. So try to beautify your own existence by embracing this third verse. And wear it always. Sometimes our mala can mean garland, but also we have our kanti mala. So one says this represents that third verse, I will say. And that for me is a nice meditation about the kanti mala. Okay. Put it around your neck. Of course, not just I put this and I'm practicing the third verse, but we have to have some reminders and be creative in one way to keep that in place. So basically saying, wear it around your neck and basically means keep it with you at every moment. Like in other words, this verse is something to be adopted as a lifestyle. It's not just like something to practice on the Sunday feast, so to say, right? Yeah. Okay, Sunday feast, time to be humble, time to be tolerant. I mean, it can be, okay, in Sunday feast. I will meet some guys that I know I will have to be tolerant with. Okay, time to be tolerant. But the rest of the day, also, the rest of my life, offer and respect, receive and respect. And as we say, knowing that we are being tolerated as well. It's not just about me tolerating the world, playing the victim, but understanding is a reciprocal way of connecting. So that's an important point here to begin with. This third verse is, it's not as an occasional add-on, weekend add-on. It's a lifetime. Not even limited to the moment we are doing kirtan, or we are chanting japa. Because we may mistakenly think, okay, I will be more humble than the blade of grass. I'm more tolerant than a tree when I'm chanting my japa in my cozy sofa in my room. And there's not much to tolerate maybe there. When you wake up from your chanting, you start to meet other people and circumstances. Okay, maybe probably that's the main moment to apply this verse. Of course, when we are chanting also, things come inside and things have to be dealt with and tolerated. So it's ideally 24/7 verse. At least in principle, again, in practice, it's a work in progress, something gradual, but that's the potential of this verse. The second time that this verse appears in Chaitanya Charitamrita is in a very interesting section where Raghunath Das Goswami is asking Mahaprabhu for some personal instruction. Remember, Raghunath Das Goswami, among the six Goswamis, he's the Prayojan Tattvacharya, which means each Goswami kind of personifies some things. Sanatan Goswami is more connected to Sambandha, Rupa Goswami with Abhideya and Rasa and other things. Jiva Goswami is the Tatpacharya and so on. Ravnadas Goswami is the Prayojan Acharya, the Acharya who personifies the Prayojan, the ultimate goal of divine love. So that's very high, very esoteric, very confidential. And that such a personality is coming to Sri Chaitanya asking for some personal instruction. So many of us may think, what will Mahaprabhu tell someone like Mahaprabhu? What will he tell to someone like Raghunath Das Goswami? Would be the supermost, highest esoteric thing possible. And I'm not saying it's not, but I'm saying we have to pay attention to Mahaprabhu, what he says to begin with in that instruction. He will say to Raghunath Das Goswami, Gramya Katana Sanivi Gramya Partana Kahim. Basically saying, don't gossip. That's the first thing Mahaprabhu say. Don't listen to gossip. Don't speak gossip. Of course, the immediate question is, was Raghunath Das Goswami known for his gossip around Radha Kunda, here and there, bringing news about the townspeople? No, that was not Raghunath Das Goswami. So he's using Raghunath Das Goswami to tell us, don't gossip. Don't engage in gramya katha. It's like village talk. You know what they did? Oh, she said that to him. And so, instead of being able to talk to people, we talk about people. That's the difference between Prajalpa and Krishna Katha, so to say. No, talking about people instead of talking to people. Now with social media and a screen in front, it becomes even easier to engage in that. We feel the right and the empowerment of having a keyword here to share to the world our opinion about everyone. But then we meet face to face and we don't say. So anyhow, that's how the instructions began. But then he continued. He said, do not eat very palatable food, extremely palatable, which was not the case of Raghunath Das Goswami, as you may recall. Do not wear fancy clothes. Maximum Raghunath Das Goswami had one extra coping, probably. So clearly this is not going to Raghunath Das Goswami, but for us to have an idea of how to reach the highest goal. And then he says, do not expect honor, offer respect to others. That's part of this third verse. And then he says, Braja Radha Krishna Seva Manasa Karibe. In your mind, serve Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan. Okay, that went a little beyond, but it started with the proper sequence. And then he says, Mahaprabhu tells to Raghunath Das Goswami, I've given you briefly my instructions. Now you go to Swarup Damodar and he will give you the details. And after saying that, interestingly, this third verse of Shikshastakam comes again. Immediately after that. Like if Mahaprabhu were to say, okay, this is what I told you. Now go to Swarup Damodar for details. But one more thing before you leave. Trinada Pisunichi in Tarora Pisunichi. Like implying, if I were to sum up all my instructions to you, this is it. Encapsulated and giving you the zip file. Everything is there. So again, that's important how Mahaprabhu is talking today. Prayojan Tatvacharya, the one who embodies the goal, implying if you want to reach that goal, we have to go through this important verse of Mahaprabhu. And the last time, the third time that this verse appears in Shikshastakam, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, is when the eight verses of Shikshastakam appear in the last chapter of the whole book, the Antilila. And it's one of the verses that receives more explanation by Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, again, highlighting how important that is. I like to think the whole eight verses of Shikshastakam, in the first verse, Mahaprabhu is praising the holy name, as you know, all the qualities, all the attributes, all the effects of chanting, right? From Cheto Darpanam Arjanam till Sarvatma Snapanam, and all in between, Param Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtana. And also in the second verse of Shikshastakam, the first three lines, still Mahaprabhu continues to praise the name. Nam Nama Karibahu, so many names, no hard and fast rules, such is your mercy. All these names have all your Shakti. So Mahaprabhu, in this almost the first two verses, he's just like showing the glories and the effects of the name. That's the thesis. No. Then in the last line of the second verse comes the antithesis. What gets in the way? Mahaprabhu said, Durdaiva Midrishami Hajjanina Anura. But I'm so unfortunate, I have no attachment for the name. Due to my anarthas, whatever, my misfortune, you will say. So there we have the problem. And then the third verse brings the solution to the problem. Mm-hmm. So it's important that we understand how the Sikshastagam is unfolding. First, these are the glories and the effects of the name. This is what gets in the way of you experiencing that. And now comes the solution of how you can experience that. And the third verse is instructing about that. And then the remaining verses is the result of embracing the third verse, which are the symptoms. What do you feel? Higher and higher and deeper and deeper. So because of this, and because of many other things that we'll try to unpack these days, I will argue that this is the third verse of Sikshastagam is for us the most important thing that Mahaprabhu has ever said. In one sense, I like to say, and I hope you understand my point, this third verse of Sikshastagam is even more important than the Mahamantra. And what do I mean by that? Oh. Wait, 1 minute. The point is that if we don't chant the name of Krishna while following this verse, there is no name of Krishna. There's some sound coming from the mouth. As we will see, Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami said, if you want to chant the name of Krishna in a way that takes you to Prem, it has to be chanted, living your life according to this verse. So in that sense, I'm saying it's even more important. In the sense that just the name, quote unquote, the name without this verse is not the name. Technically speaking, the name of Krishna is the name of Krishna chanted with a certain attitude, with a certain mood, with a certain lifestyle. So it's very important. I like to call this third verse the golden rule of Sri Chaitanya. You have this idea of the golden rule in other traditions. Like many times the golden rule is mostly like treat others as you wish to be treated. Now you find that in Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, even in Mahabharata, there are lines like that. Jainism, Native American, everywhere. It's like an all-pervading cross-cultural golden rule. So somehow, this is the same idea. Mahaprabhu is inviting to respect, to honor, and because we all want also to be, not to be honored, but to be respected from a deep way, to be loved from a deep way. So for me personally, this verse has been so important that a few years ago, I remember, was not in my plan, but the inspiration came, and fortunately the inspiration lasted for me to do it. And the inspiration came to, okay, next year, let's do a meditation on this verse. So every day of the year, I will write one page of reflections on this verse. And it happened by Krishna's grace. So I don't know where it is now. It's in Argentina, I think, but I had the notebook of the 365 pages of, and for me, the main intention was also, okay, I want to awaken to all that there is in this verse. So if I really commit myself for 365 days to try to go deep in this verse, something will come. And of course, not only something, but so much came. So throughout these days, hopefully, I may be able to share some of the things that came those days. And also, in a few books that I'm writing now, I'm also talking about this third verse of Sikshastagam from different perspectives. So I like to to share with you some of those ideas. So that's it. Let's go to the verse for a minute. Trinada Pisunichena, Tadori Vasa Hishnuna, Amani Namanadena, Kirtaniya Sadahari. I have a short poetic rendition of it, so I'd like to share it with you. It says, be as humble as the quiet grass, as enduring as the ancient tree. Seek not the praise of men, but honor every soul you see. With this heart, sing the name of Hari endlessly. So this, the third verse, the golden rule of Sri Chaitanya. In the previous verse, as you remember, second verse, last line, Mahaprabhu is speaking about his bad behavior, not him, his own, but ours. Actually, he's saying, I don't feel attraction for the name because of my misfortune. Misfortune means an artha, right? Artha means, in Sanskrit, fortune, wealth. Anartha means misfortune or a false sense of wealth, like counterfeit money, right? When you project value in something that where there is not. Basically, that's an artha. So Mahaprabhu is speaking in the second verse about his misbehavior, again, ours, not his, but he's entering that mood for our benefit. And from speaking about his misbehavior in this third verse, he's speaking about what? Proper behavior. Achar, proper behavior. This third verse speaks about proper behavior. And of course, Mahaprabhu not only speaks about proper behavior, he walks his talk. No, he's well known for speaking this verse, but he's even more well known for embodying this verse. There are so many examples. We won't go there now, but so many examples throughout Mahaprabhu's life and Lila of him showing humility, tolerance, respect, modesty, and chanting the name of Krishna endlessly. But it's interesting, that was last year. I was also reflecting on this verse, and I was in Alachua, in Pranada's house. And I remember she had the Vishnu Sahasranam. I never went through that in detail, which is the 1,000 names of God. And I felt, okay, let's try it. So I started to go one by one and try to reflect. Took some time, as you can imagine, 1,000. And I was very amused and surprised to find that three of those names are actually names related to this third verse of Shikshastra. So these names are names of Vishnu, which means names of Mahaprabhu. We are talking about the same person here. So one name there was Sahishnu. We have Tarodiva Sahishnuna. One name of God is Sahishnu, he who tolerates everything, starting by me. Okay, Krishna, thank you. So when I'm invited to tolerate, I can immediately think, well, first I'm being tolerated so much, so I should do it gracefully and joyfully. So one name, again, Mahaprabhu is not just saying Taroriva Sahishnuna, be tolerant like it. His name is Sahishnu. And remember, between Krishna's names and himself, there is no difference. If he's known as Sahishnu, means he is that. He is his name, Sahishnu. Another name he has is Amani. In this list, Amani, he who has no pride. And he will invite us to Amanina. He who is Amani leads by example, right? And another name, as you can imagine, is Manada. So Manada means giver of honor. So he's already doing what he's inviting us to do. That's a perfect teacher. No, that's a perfect teacher. That person is sharing something, but before sharing something, he or she is doing that. So that's the integrity of God. Let's put it that way, right? Whatever he expects from us, he's already doing that in the best possible way. Also, I like to think of this third verse of Shikshastakam as, how to say, as some sort of preliminary things to have in place before entering into the practice. Many times I hear devotees telling me, oh Maharaj, I'm chanting for 30 years, 40 years, and not much is going on. That's in the top five of questions that I receive in my journey, in my travels. That's between one of the main five. Like, why? No, I'm not feeling anything. What's going on? And I'm not saying there's only one answer to that, because each case is unique, and why that's going on, that's it. But probably in big part, that's connected to this. I may overemphasize chanting, or I may overemphasize a number of chanting. I'm not against that, but I may not emphasize enough the spirit, the attitude through which the chanting will bear its fruit. So I may become over concerned, even obsessed with reaching the quota, so to say. But how much this third verse is present in our heart? Again, not only during chanting, during living. Our chanting should be our living. Our living should be our chanting. So, so this verse in one sense is a very important preliminary consideration before you jump into a life of chanting, how we are conducting ourselves in our daily basis in our relationship with other people. I like to think, for example, in yoga, in the Ashtanga yoga system, of course, we have yama, niyama, right? Asana, pranayama, and so on. Pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. So before, in the yoga sequence that I'm just mentioned, first you have yama, niyama, which means a set of moral codes and ways of behaving in your life. Then it speaks about, okay, now sit down. Now let's try to do some breathing exercise to concentrate. Then you try to it's not just meditate. No. First is, are you stealing? Are you lying? Are you behaving in the... First, let's have that in place. That's a preliminary consideration. For example, with pranayama, this breathing exercise, if that's not done with proper background, if we are not properly situated in yama niyama first, things like pranayama can be dangerous, actually. That's explained by many yoga teachers. It's not like, oh, just do some inhalation and that's fine, that's cool. If I go deep into that and I'm not leading a lifestyle that is aligned with the yoga teachings, all the subsequent stages can be dangerous because I don't have stage one and two in place first. You follow my point? Mm-hmm. So in the same way, I will say, in one sense, and again, bear with me and understand my point, chanting the name of Krishna can be dangerous if I don't have the third verse in place first. Again, it's not that the name of Krishna is dangerous, but the way we may relate to the practice can be counterproductive if I'm not concerned with having this ethic of living my life according to this verse. For example, why? Because I can just chant the name of Krishna, chant my 16 rounds or whatever. And that can create a toxic sense of certainty. I'm already chanting my rounds. I'm doing it. And I'm not concerned at all with the third verse of Chakshasana. So I'm chanting my 16 rounds, but I'm having dysfunctional relationship with everyone around me. But I'm chanting my 16 rounds. So nobody can tell me anything, not even Krishna, because I can show him the checkbox, 16, okay? Daily quota in. Bhagavan, my life is a mess, my relationships are a mess, but no, it doesn't work. So my point is, my chanting can become a form of spiritual bypassing. I can hide myself in the fact that I'm reaching the legal number per day while I'm not really taking the time to work in my relationships, which this verse is all about. In that way, I'm saying chanting the name of Krishna can be dangerous if I don't have these preliminary considerations in place. Or kirtan, which is, of course, another form of chanting the name, japa kirtan. Kirtan can become mere aesthetic entertainment if the third verse is not in place. My kirtan can become more musical than mystical, to make a play of words. And kirtan is not musical entertainment. I mean, there is musicality and there's lots of nice things, but not at the cost of forgetting the third verse, right? So, or even again, going back to japa. I've seen about sometimes japa becomes, unfortunately, that's not the idea, of course, but becomes like a catatonic repetition without depth of experience. And the more you repeat something in a catatonic way, it's numbing. It's numbing you. It's not awakening you. Follow my point? The more we repeat something from the wrong place, in one sense, the worse it is. If I'm doing something in the wrong way, the more I do that, do the math. It doesn't get better. If I'm accustomed to chant my rounds while, I don't know, while checking social media, the more I do that, the worse. It's not that, no, continue chanting, Mara. The point is that that's not chanting. That's checking social media. So it's not getting any better the more I do it. It gets worse and worse. So there's so many ways we can chant the name of Krishna from the wrong place. Not to make anyone neurotic, just to be aware that there are ways to engage in practice from the wrong place. And the more we do that, the worse. And of course, then we shouldn't wonder why after 20, 30 years, I'm not feeling anything. If that's the case, in our case, hopefully this is not your case, but sometimes that happens, let's be honest. So I will say that this verse of Shikshastakam is an important injection to keep our, not only our chanting, but our life and relationships alive, dynamic, open. So having this verse in place, at least on some level, again, it's not that, okay, in 1 week and I process the third verse, I'm there. It's an ongoing work. But at least as much as we can incorporate that, and then we can practice. And we are not skipping stages, so to say. I will argue that this third verse will help to make our practice healthy, sustainable, relatable. Of course, we will also address, especially the next class, how this verse can be interpreted in a toxic way. How so many times when we speak about humility, we can weaponize humility or tolerance to justify abuse and stuff like that. And that's not the third verse of Shikshastaka. But also we need to have a healthy understanding of it, of course. So as I say, for me, this third verse is very important, not only in chanting, while chanting, but how we relate to others on a day-to-day basis. And how our practice and our life ideally have to become one. No, it's not, because sometimes in the beginning we make this difference. My practice, my life. I even heard about saying, my spiritual life, my material life. It's like, okay, you want to create that dichotomy, that separation, that's your creation. That's not necessary. The more we separate and keep our material life in our mind, okay, that becomes our material life. But ideally, everything can be part of our spiritual life. And my practice and my life, in one sense, ideally should merge into the same thing. It's not that, okay, I have my practice, and now comes something different from that. Ideally, the two have to become the same. Even if you're working, you have family, that ideally is part of your practice, of your relationship with Krishna, of your developing your Krishna consciousness. So this is the type of integration that gradually should happen. This characterizes most, I would say, the Madhyam Bhakta, the intermediate devotee. In the beginning, our practice in Kanishta level, we have a more like my life, my practice, more black and white, separated thing. But Madhyam, intermediate, integration of this. And this verse speaks of Nishta, which is very connected to Madhyam Bhakti, integration. How my life and my practice can become one. In other words, how my relationship, it's not that I relate to Krishna on one side and then I relate to everyone else and that's absolutely unrelated. No. It's very interconnected, interrelated. It's not that I'm worshiping the deity and I'm crying and offering garlands and jai, gaur nitai, then the altar closes and I do not treat you very nicely. In the beginning, that happens. Scripture says in the beginning, the Kanishta worship Krishna on the altar, but doesn't know how to relate to anyone else. So as long as the altar is open, everything is fine. The altar closed, I know what to do with all of you now. But of course, that's not the final standard of Archana. No. So this verse points to that. How we practice, how we chant the name, is how we live our life, how we relate to others. I like to share with you, we have a few more minutes. We have eternity, so it's okay. A few verses from the Bhagavatam that I like very much. These are very strong verses, but trying to make a point from the third canto, ninth chapter, instructions of Kapila Deva to Devahuti. And he's speaking on Archana here, but also on Archana in connection to worshipping the deity and what happens after worshipping the deity in my relationship with others. So these are seven verses. I will suggest that you fasten your seatbelt first. It says like this. Kapila Dev is talking. He's Bhagavan, God himself. So he's talking as Bhagavan in that mode. He says, am I ever existent as the supreme immanent self in all living entities? If one disregards any of them and thus disregards me by extension, and yet worships my deity form, he makes a mockery of such worship. Should I continue? That's the first one only. Yeah. If one neglects to see the Supreme Lord present in all living beings as the self and worships my deity form, he indeed is offering oblations into ashes. That's implying doesn't mean anything. If a person offers respects to me, but is inimical to other beings, hating other bodies, not seeing other suffering as equal as to his own, his mind does not attain peace. Even if someone worships with proper rituals and paraphernalia, a person who is ignorant of my presence in all living beings never pleases me by the worship of my deity in the temple. Performing his prescribed duties, one should worship the deity until one realizes my presence in his own heart and in the hearts of other living entities as well. That's big fruit of Archana. He who creates an internal distinction between oneself and others, separateness. For him, holding that divisive view, death brings terrible fear. Therefore, one should honor me as the self residing in all beings by being charitable and considerate with an undivided vision of friendship to all. Sri Kapila Dev Ki Jai. That's Archana. That's Archana, proper Archana, right? We worship the deity, and we worship everyone else, perceiving the presence of God in everyone's heart, right? So this is, I'm quoting this verse because, again, this third verse of Shikshasakam is very much about Kirtaniya Sadahari, always chant the name of Krishna, but all these qualities in how to relate with everyone else and not create like a separation between these two. Krishna is everywhere. It's in everyone. So how you relate to everyone, everywhere, and everyone speaks how we relate to God. It's not like, okay, I love you, Krishna, so much, but I hate all of you, sorry. Mm. It's not possible because he's in everyone else as well. Mm. So how we relate to something is how we relate to everything else. Mm. Mm. So in that sense, Archana is not confined to the altar. We have to begin somewhere, and in the beginning, okay, we'll be more sectarian, more fanatical, more separatistic. It's part of being a kindergarten in bhakti. It's okay. There's place for that. The problem is when we are ready to upgrade to the next level and we insist on remaining there, right? So everything deserves reverence, veneration. That's what the third verse is about. And the way we relate to others also speaks how we are relating to Krishna. It's interconnected. Because to love Krishna is to love everything that is in connection to Krishna, right? That's Jiva Goswami's purport in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He says bhakti means to love Krishna, and he says then, but that's a narrow definition of bhakti. He himself says a broader definition is to love Krishna and everything that is related to Krishna. And then the question is, so what's related to Krishna? Everything. So that's like, oops, that's complicated. Okay, so I have to love everything, basically, right? Loving Krishna means loving everything. Okay, I'll try. Because loving Krishna sounded more easy. Okay, I have to love that particular person. He seems pretty charming, interesting, so it may be not that difficult. But then I realize Well, in one sense, loving Krishna is loving everything in connection to him. So, and I always quote this famous sentence from Dorothy Day. She's a Christian contemporary mystic. We shared that the other day in Nelson. Badra reminds it, remembers it. That we, no, but you remember that I quoted that.
Yes, I've been thinking about that quote a lot.
All right, great. That's a very powerful one. Do you want me to share it? Okay. Fasten your seatbelt again, please. And I will repeat it at least twice because it needs to sink in. She says, in connection to this, to how our love for Krishna becomes reflected in all our relationships, all. She says, I only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. I'll repeat it again and let that sink in. I only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. You get the point? So whatever affection I have for Krishna will be reflected in any and every relationship, especially in those that I consider the least. It has to extend in every direction. There's this famous line, how we do anything is how we do everything. So how do I relate to something is how I relate to everything else. Right? So this third verse of Shikshastakam invites us to that. Okay, seeing the name of Krishna always, but what's the name of Krishna? Everything is connected. What Mahaprabhu says in the second verse, Niya Sarva Shaktis, all the Shaktis are in the name of Krishna. We are one of those Shaktis, Tatasva Shakti. So you want to always honor the name of Krishna. The name of Krishna is not different from Krishna himself, and Krishna himself does not exist disconnected from any of us. So honoring Krishna means the bigger version, the broader idea of Krishna includes everything and everyone. Let's try to make a miser version of Krishna. No, Krishna can. Let's make Krishna mean the least possible. No, the most possible. What was all that he is, and we are connected to him. Everything is connected to him. So chanting the name of Krishna is not just connecting to Krishna, but connecting to everything else. Because in the name of Krishna, all energies are there. We are one energy. The material world is another energy. So I have to develop my relationship with everything. So that's for me the broadest idea of chanting the name of Krishna. Not just I'm chanting this name and relating to only this person, him and me, and everyone else is excluded from that. No. Everything and everyone is included in that. So for me, chanting the name of Krishna is developing my relationship of love with Krishna. But again, Krishna does not exist in isolation. Let's not be that cruel with Krishna and put him in a bubble. Okay, Krishna, you go there. That's your place. You exist separated from everything. The moment you think like that, that's no longer Krishna. That's our own idea about God. But our ideas about God are not God. We can have so many ideas about Krishna that do not match the actual reality of who Krishna is. So, anyhow, I don't want to go over and over again on this, but just making this point that how this verse is, it's a whole lifestyle. Again, it's not something to bring to memory a few minutes per day or something, but it's an ethic. It's for me the ultimate ethic, how to live life, how to relate to everyone, to everything. Even in the smallest, quote-unquote, more insignificant moments, how I'm related when I'm peeling a potato. Whatever. No. Krishna is everywhere, always. So there's always a chance to apply this verse. And to conclude, I'd like to think of this verse as most of you know about this expression, the four regulative principles. Right? Okay. So mostly these are connected to these four principles, and that's in a whole different conversation that generally, they are translated as no meat eating, no, four no's, right? Personally, I don't like to describe them starting with no, but finding the positive version of the no, right? Because if not, we kind of define our practice in terms of what we don't do, No. What do you do in your as a Gaudiya Vaishnava? I don't do this and I don't do that. But what do you do? Do you do something or you just don't do something? So of course, if I ask you, so what's your one of the principles? No meat eating. No, the principle is no meat eating. You can say, okay, something broader, vegetarianism. No, no, broader. The principle as it appears in the Bhagavatam is ahimsa. These four pillars. Ahimsa. And ahimsa still is negative, right? Because ahimsa means non-violence. So what would be a positive expression of not being violent? You tell me.
Merciful.
Being merciful. Compassionate.
Smaller than names.
Yeah. Kind, loving, compassionate. And not only being merciful, compassionate, but being as merciful as you can. If we can extend the principle as much as we can. So again, that's for me the real principle. It's not no meat eating. It's be as loving and kind as you can. So in the same way, we have these four principles. But I like to refer to this verse of Shikshastaka as another set of four regulative principles. Sunichena, Sahishnuna, Amanina, Manadina. So it's another way of thinking, okay, these are my four regulative principles. In a more devotional way, how I relate to others. No? The other four are crucial, but more of like become a human, basically. Behave like a human being. No? These other ones are like a deeper, I will say, expression of the same principles. So I like to think about these verses, the four regulative principles, the 2.0 or something like that. And as we say, this verse represents, according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Nishta. So nishtha means fixity, stability in sadhana, absorption. Nishtha in exhibiting the qualities of this verse. And nishtha for most of us is the next goal to attain. And for most practitioners, they may be practicing in anishchita bhajana kriya, unstable bhakti, ups and downs. Part of the journey, so that's glorious in itself, not to be extra embarrassed. So the short-term goal to attain for most of us is nishtha. So this verse represents nishtha. And Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, as we say, he says, if you want to attain the long-term goal of divine love, you will attain it by embracing this verse and practicing through the qualities described in the third verse of Shikshastaka. And from that place, I'm saying, this verse is more important than the Maha Mantra in that sense. The Maha Mantra will come to life by living our life, embracing the third verse. So, anyhow, a few thoughts I want to share today. It's more like a warming up to the verse itself. Maybe in the next session, we will go line by line and try to explain what it means to be more humble than a blade of grass in a way that is not dysfunctional psychologically, right? What it means to be more tolerant than a tree in a way that is not supporting abuse and be tolerant, no? What it means to give respect and not expect respect in a way that we are not chastising ourselves in a way that we become full of guilt and shame, and how to honor others when they behave in a way that doesn't seem too honorable, and all these nuances and how to apply and understand this verse. So that will be the next one. I don't know if there are any questions you may like to ask in connection to this topic, since in the evening we will have questions, but on any topic or any theme, but maybe to keep the today's topic in place, if there are any questions or thoughts or something you may like to share, Arjuna.
Sometimes we hear Krishna speaking with what seems like a lot of bhakti, but then these same people are eating meat, and occasionally Christians will defend meat eating by saying animals are lower than us. So how is it that someone in another religion can seemingly have some deep understanding of God while eating meat?
Okay. Theology unleashed now. Yeah. I have my own podcast, so I know what it means to it becomes part of, it's us, no? It's not a separate character. Thank you, Arjuna. He asks good questions. I've been in his podcast a few times, so I already warm up. So well, that's a long conversation. And I know that there are different opinions about this. Some opinions will be more like, okay, if you are not vegetarian, let's put it that way, you eat meat of sorts, you cannot be. I mean, just to present the radical view, if you want to put it, one of the radicalists, you cannot be spiritual. There's no possibility at all. And then you have the other extreme, which is, it doesn't make any difference at all. And you have all the nuances in between, which are endless. I personally vote for some form of gray in between the black and white. I personally don't feel that someone who is not a vegetarian has no possibility of bhakti or no access to deep things. Of course, there are different cases here, because, and even this is in Shastra, for example, it says, if you eat meat, but you are not aware of what's implied in the meat eating, the reaction to that is not the same as if you are conscious of what entails to get that meat, especially if we are talking in an industrialized way that the meat is produced, because also to be fair and bring different elements in the Vedas, you find different sections where there are sacrifices where animals are offered, which again is not the same thing as just supporting a slaughterhouse, let's put it that way. But there's ritual killing of animals. And there are great devotees in our tradition who are not vegetarian. I remember a few years ago, I made a post and I shared a quote. And I know this can activate some in connection to this topic, but I shared a quote from Jordan Peterson. And of course, he's well known for many things. And one of those is that he has an only meat diet. No? So that can, like, okay, Maharaj, that's too much. How you dare to share a quote? And someone basically commented that. No, but the comment was more like, there can be no possible wisdom in someone whose diet is based only on meat. And for me, I say, I disagree. I mean, I disagree. I get your point, but I wouldn't take it to that extreme. And if you make the case that if you eat meat, there is no possibility of wisdom, and I try to do this play of words with the person. Okay, you are Gaudiya Vaishnava, I ask the person. Yes. Okay, one of our main books is Bhagavad Gita, right? Yes. Okay, one of the main two characters there is Arjuna, right? Yes. Do you accept wisdom coming from Arjuna? Yes. Okay, he's not vegetarian. How about that? Arjuna is not vegetarian.
Sure.
Are you sure? Go to the Mahabharata, go to the Bhagavatam, different sections. There's hunting of animals and they are eating some of those. Kshatriya has that permission if you want to make the... So I'm bringing this not to hopefully disturb your faith in the Bhagavad Gita and in Arjuna, but just to show there's more nuance than what we can think of, no? And I personally know, and of course by saying this, I'm not saying, okay, guys, let's have some beef today for lunch, and that's the same. It's okay. I'm not saying that. Just to clarify, I won't come with that invitation. Just in case. But also, we have to, I will say we have to be careful not to be too judgmental and put people in boxes just because they eat meat. Because also, you can develop a superiority complex by the fact of you being a vegetarian, and the actual principle, as we were telling, is to be loving and kind. And I understand if the meat in one sense could be seen as that's not very loving and kind, but you can be the staunchest vegan and you can be so violent in so many other ways by the fact that you are not following my diet or who knows what. No, I don't know many vegetarian people who I know were violent, literally beating their wives or doing very crazy stuff. And so you follow my point, right? It's not just I'm following this diet that warranties that my bhakti is deeper, that I'm non-violent, probably not. And I know people who admit who are very loving and kind in many ways. So, And I cannot deny that because I'm having firsthand experience, and they have very deep realizations, very deep experiences. So it can be a little bewildering because we have our maybe set of beliefs, or okay, if you are like this, this is this. If it's not like that, it must be this. And then you start to find, okay, it's not as black and white as I thought. So, and maybe I cannot ascertain, okay, what's their level of depth? What's their level of bhakti? Where they are they going to the spiritual world or not? That's a mystery in one sense for me. And I'm okay with coexisting with that mystery. But yeah, I will personally, based on my firsthand experience, make a case for you can have very much lots of depth in your spirituality, even while not being a vegetarian. I'm a vegetarian just in case. I'm not planning to leave my body. and I have my reasons to defend that. And I've had conversations with different practitioners who are not vegetarian and asking them sincerely, like, how you understand this? Because my belief, my understanding is this. And they have their understanding. They have their own ways of thinking about that. It's not that they're like, I don't want to talk about it. Something. Sumuki, Shuret, and then we go to Admananda Prabhu. Yes.
Maharaj, you were talking about integration, about material life and spiritual life integration. And then I was just wondering how sometimes in our spiritual journey there seems to be a lack of integration as well, because, you know, if you're going through a very difficult time for whatever reason, and you're feeling very sort of anxious and vulnerable and disturbed, then it's quite hard in that state of mind to feel the love of Krishna or feel that you're being sheltered and protected. Of course, we have to thank Kunji who asked for those qualities, but that's very advanced. So I've just been thinking lately how do we look at times in our spiritual life where we're being faced with... Basically, it's coming from the anatta. There's some anatta there, or there's some conditioning that's causing you to suffer and not being able to apply purely the principles of Krishna consciousness. And that, you know, yet to have that integration, you understand what I mean?
Well, what I can say from my own journey and experience, which, of course, has all the messiness of any other one, other's journey and experience. There's no journey which goes like in straight line to Golok or something like that. So there's always ups and downs in the journey. And first of all, I will like to emphasize that, not like to normalize messiness. Because we have been very expert at stigmatizing messiness. And putting a very high standard of you're expected to be the perfect Vedic wife and the ultra high brahmachari and the pure devotee this and that. And sometimes we have sure standards that correspond with pure devotee, and you are not a pure devotee. So you try to be a pure devotee without being a pure devotee. It doesn't work. And it's exhausting and it's neurotic and you feel discouraged and guilt and shame. And on top of that, if you add on ideas like Krishna is angry with you and he won't be that pleased, and only when you do things in this way he's accepting you, which is that's not true, but those ideas come. You put all that together, you know what's the result of that, right? So first I will say it's very necessary in healing to normalize failure, to normalize mess, not to promote that, but just to understand that's part of the journey. That's mentioned in Shastra. So I like to say when Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes all these nine stages of bhakti in his Madhurya Kadambini, when he comes to bhajana kriya or engagement in bhajan in practice, he goes to this anishtita bhajana kriya, unstable bhakti. And he goes to each one of these six nuances he presents. Utsahamayi, Enghanatarala, Bhiddhavikalpa, Tarangarangini, and so on. Well, each one of those is more embarrassing than the previous one. And I always joke with the devotees when we go through them in detail. Number one, Utsamayi means this. Raise your hand who has gone through that. Everyone's like, when they go, they do in the soccer stadiums, like, shh. Number two, who has those? No, people, the woods are taking four arm forms and raising four arms. The more I, and all of them we are in, the six of them. So my point with this is, okay, and all of them are embarrassing and messy, and but all of them, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is presenting them as part of the bhakti journey. So as messy as those things are, those are confirming that you are on the journey. Those are part of the practice. They're not the goal, but they are an unavoidable chapter of your journey that you need to embrace and go through and accept. So I think that first we have to allow, accept that we will go through those moments, through suffering, through doubt. Again, not that let's look for that as much as we can, but just let's welcome them when they knock on our door without stigmatizing that, ourselves or others. Let's know, the other day we were talking with a devotee, the expression, let's normalize normalcy. Let's invoke more common sense, uncommon sense, uncommon common sense. And let's create spaces where devotees can share their messiness. Again, not promote let's remain there, but just let's realize how all of us are going through similar things. It's because if not, you isolate yourself, like suffering. You spoke about suffering. And of course, we all know what that it means. I don't think you will tell me, I don't know what suffering is, Mara. Probably that's one of the things we are most familiar with. But sometimes we are ashamed of talking about that because you're not supposed to suffer. You are supposed to be blissful. If you're suffering, that means you are an illusion. So let not everyone know that you are an illusion and all that type of stuff that is like, everyone knows we are suffering, but nobody's talking about it. So why not talking about it? Because when you talk about it, you realize, oh, I'm not the only one going through that. And that's one of the most liberating things. Because when we go through suffering or doubt or shame or guilt or whatever, we tend to isolate ourselves in that experience and not realize this is a universal experience that everyone is going through. You follow my point? So when you say, oh, Maharaj, I have this suffering, my suffering, and I will correct it. No, it's not your suffering, it's our suffering. Don't make it like a hyper-localized experience that only you are going through. You have to universalize it. It's our suffering. It's a collective experience. Everyone knows what doesn't mean to suffer. So when you universalize it, you can have more compassion for others and more compassion for yourself. No, it's not just only me going through this messy stuff. I'm such a wreck or I'm such what. No, it's normal and everyone is going through that. So I think that's a preliminary consideration. And the more we do that, the more we also will perceive Krishna's presence in our lives and how he's already accepting us in those moments, in every moment, including those moments. But we have to allow ourselves to be seen by God in those moments. He's seeing us, but sometimes when we are in messy chapters, if we hide, if we engage in secrecy, I don't want anyone to know what I'm going through. We are not perceiving Krishna's love and Krishna's presence because we are isolating ourselves, hiding. So Krishna is seeing us even in our hiding. But for us to feel his presence, we need to come out of hiding. You follow my point? So that's what I like to call darshan. Darshan doesn't mean so much to see, but to be seen. And Krishna already is seeing you. But we have to have the voluntary act of presenting ourselves to him, voluntary. that's our part. We cannot expect him to do everything. It's a mutual relationship. We want to relate to him. It's toxic if in a relationship I expect you do the 100% and I just enjoy what you are giving to me. That's not a relationship. That's a monologue. It's not a dialogue. I will try to emphasize those things. And on a personal level, the moments I've gone through the most suffering in my life, which were, as a devotee, I would say, I mean, I'm not faulting, blaming bhakti for that. I'm just saying it happened to be that way because, it happened to in some intense chapters there. But for Krishna's mercy, I was able to feel his presence more than ever in those moments also. So pain is a very, suffering is something that opens our heart a lot. There are two things that opens our heart a lot. Great love, great suffering. So we have to allow suffering to do its part. Of course, we are opened, torn apart, raw, and we have to stay there. That's the thing. We don't need to like feel some urgency. You have to leave this place as soon as possible. This feels unsettling, uncomfortable. I'm not as pretty as I would like to be. But trying to understand, I need to those moments also. If I'm open and I accept that, Krishna will be felt so really, in such a real way, in such an intense, profound way. So I think in general we need to promote and normalize suffering, messiness. Again, not to promote let's suffer as much as we can, but to promote when you are suffering, accept it and learn from it. Don't escape from that. Don't see there's something bad that needs to be avoided. It has its lessons. So we have to sit with it. As I like to say, not sit on top of it, but sit with it and engage in conversation. Because if you don't learn the lesson that suffering wants to give you, well, next time it will come again with double force, with double higher volume, so you can listen more. Okay, there's something to learn. And next time even more, and next time even more. So we need to integrate the lesson from pain, from suffering. And learn to suffer. It's not so much about stopping to suffer. It's learning to suffer. When you love, you suffer. You think there's no suffering in Golok Vrindavan? There is a lot of suffering, but not in any way that we have experienced suffering so far, just in case. But there are so many quotes in Shastra about the extreme suffering, I don't know, Radha and Krishna in separation of each other. They feel they are dying. That's suffering. But in love, that's what makes the whole difference. Learning to suffer in the context of love. So that makes suffer have its purpose. So even if we are not in love in the sense of I'm not in Golok Vrindavan, I don't have prema bhakti, but I may be suffering here and now, and I can open my heart to other people in trust that I trust in safe space, and that's suffering in love, well, with people that will receive me, understand me, listen to me. So that suffering becomes not only redeemed, but redemptive, right? So there's no need to escape suffering. We can see suffering as a redemptive portal, so to say. So I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, thank you, that's good.
Okay. And Arjuna didn't have a question. Atmananda Prabhu had a question or some comment.
Well, first of all, thank you very much, Mara.
Thank you.
I feel honored to be here and appreciative of the devotees here. Many things have come up. In terms of Sumukhi's question, you made the point about it's not your suffering, it's our suffering.
Mm.
And there's, I don't know who said it, but the principle that what is most personal is most general.
Most universal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at the same time, when I think about, because I can talk about, or I can discuss about suffering, but to admit it myself, it's something I very strongly avoid.
Mm.
I'm afraid of doing.
Mm.
And you mentioned, of course, sharing with someone we trust, and also opening ourselves to Krishna. Not that he's just seeing us, but yes, he's seeing me, and I need to tell him. It's really helpful for me to tell him what's going on, because then I accept that there's a relationship
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. And another question came up that I was going to ask before. You're talking about how, I think in the sixth line of Kapila, sixth verse or whatever, mm-hmm. point that Kapila Dev made to Devahuti about how we relate to other living beings and seeing other living beings, same as myself.
Mm-hmm.
and trying to love everyone, then I wonder how that relates to making a distinction, as described in the Nectar of Instruction, that we need to relate with certain people, including devotees, in certain ways, and avoid others, even devotees. Mm. So that's a question that came to mind. Mm. And maybe it's too broad a discussion, but that came to me.
Mm. Thank you. First of all, thank you, and I appreciate your presence here to begin with, and then the points you made before the question. I resonate with each one of those. Yeah, and regarding your question, I will say, okay, how to see everyone as me, or how to respect, or we will go there in a few days more in detail, but a trailer now here, how to discern and discriminate, as the scripture clearly mentioned, between how we relate to people and at the same time follow this type of sections of Shastra, which invite to love everyone, let's say, accept everyone, embrace everyone. Of course, there are different people in different stages of the journey, also different devotees. So, for example, as we were saying, some instructions that we find here are not intended for a neophyte. No, there may be too much. The neophyte needs to have more boundaries, more black and white thinking. They will over idealize some people, like, I don't know, like a boy, like a baby, not like a 3-4 year old. They will think their parents are God, literally. They made an experiment recently with the kids where someone came to a group of kids, 2-year-old or something, 3. Okay, let's play this game. And they explained to the kids which was the game. The kids were playing the game. And then they asked the kids, so do you know who created this game? And the kid was like, my father. I mean, no doubt. He went there like, dad. Like, implying, and what about this game? Who created that? My father. So daddy was God. Just to know, Arjuna, the responsibility on your shoulders. Of course, gradually the idea is that the kids will grow to the point of realizing, okay, that is not God, and so on and so forth. Or even in the beginning, baby and mother is like a sayujya, it's like emerging, we are one. Gradually, the baby starts to realize, okay, I'm a separate being. So in the same way, my point with this is, in certain stage of the journey, we need to have certain patterns of thinking, that certain instructions, like some of the ones I read today, can be too much for someone in the kindergarten chapter. Then we have these instructions to discern and discriminate how to relate to everyone, which are applicable to, I would say, most of the devotees, not to the highest devotee, again, because the highest devotee is just seeing Krishna everywhere. So there's no discernment in one sense. There's just an overflow of love. But we cannot just press a button and be there. Although I will argue we can know that, okay, that's the ideal way how I should see everyone. I don't have that vision. I'll try to operate from that. I know that in principle, let's put it this way. I know that in principle, Krishna is in every heart. I don't have the realization. I don't seeing that. I know it's the case. Maybe sometimes I had a glimpse of that. I know that everyone is loved by Krishna unconditionally. So that's a point. Again, I'm not having the realization, but in theory, I know that's the case. So I try to keep that somewhere in me when I'm relating to everyone. But also according to my realization, in some cases, I may need to take a distance from some people, which doesn't mean I'm hating them, right? It's just, okay, I'm not a Nutan Bhagavat, and I don't have the greater capacity to remain with everyone and not be affected, and in turn affect them positively. I cannot just go to the local, I don't know, brothel and liberate all the inhabitants there by my very presence. I'm not Nityananda Prabhu. I'm going to the local bar and everyone ends up doing Sankirtan. Probably I will end up following their footsteps. So I have to ascertain where I am. Right, so that's a little bit the intention of this. Like, Swasve dikari janishta saguna parikirtita. Srimad Bhagavatam say, to establish what's your adhikar, that's real piety. So adhikar means where you are now, what's your capacities, how much you can deal with something or not. Bhaktivinoda Thakur will translate that verse to, that's real beauty, to act according to who you are, where you are now. No need to be more, no need to be less. Because both can happen. I can try to be less of what I'm ready to be, or I can try to be more, but why do I need to be more? Why I'm not satisfied with where I am and grow from there? So I will say, with that in place, again, in theory, we have this idea. Krishna is everywhere. Everyone is loved by Krishna. But in my situation and capacity, in some cases, I need to take a distance. So I can see that in that person. So I can remind myself, oh, he's loved by Krishna. Oh, there's always something good about everyone. Sometimes I need to take a distance to be able to see that. Because like Rupa Goswami will say, with an envious person, the general advice is you take distance. But interestingly, what he says is all these relationships he mentioned, you love Krishna, you are friends with devotees, you are merciful to the innocent, you take distance from the envious. All those stances are in service. In service to the innocent, I'm compassionate to them. In service to the Vaishnava, I'm friend. In service to the envious, I take a distance from them. Why? Because if I remain too close, the envious probably becomes even more envious. So I'm not helping them. Right? So even my distancing from someone is done in the spirit of seva, not in the spirit of I hate you, you are so envious, such a black snake you are, right? And increasing my judgment. And no, I'm taking a distance from you so I can appreciate you. I can see something good in you, because I'm not capable of doing that when we are too close. I take responsibility. I don't have that capacity also. That's part of, I will try to do my best so next time we meet, I can deal with your envy in a more healthy way, that I don't need to distance myself from you. That's another way of putting it. Not to put all the responsibility on my shoulders, but also to take responsibility. Right? So yeah, that's again, this verse from Kapila Deva, in principle, giving this, in principle, Krishna is everywhere, in every person, don't forget that. But in practice, we may need sometimes to take a distance. We may not be able just to embrace everyone and shed tears of compassion and redeem each other at every step. Sometimes we may need to be a little bit more discerning. But what's discernment in every stage, that's different, right? So I hope that helps. I don't know.
Yeah, I like your point about doing it in a mood of service.
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. It takes different shapes. Love takes different shapes.
There's a certain recommended Christian approach to a narcissist, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Don't even try to help him. Don't confront him, because he'll misuse that. I mean, it's pretty much expanding on what you said about avoiding someone, because an envious person may become more envious.
Yeah.
Make more offenses.
Mm. Yeah, and from that distance, we can even pray for that person, no? In a well-wishing spirit. So you can still show love. That's the thing, no? You can, you may take the form of distance, but if the distance is the most favorable circumstance for me to show love to you, what matters is that I'm ending up showing love to you. So, and I can be next to you physically, but I'm not being too loving. So what's proximity? What's service? What's love? It's not what's going on externally, what's happening inside.
And maybe it's service to myself as well, because if I'm not ready, as you say, I can't redeem. I need to protect myself, my own bhakti.
Yes.
Not to.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, because that's a whole huge important conversation, which is the topic of self-love, for example. Right. We did some lectures in the past on self-love in bhakti. And again, unconditional love has to be loving in all directions. You know? So if I'm trying to love you, it has to be in a way that is loving to me also. It's not that my love to you goes back to me in a way of dysfunction and violence. And no, love has to be loving in every possible direction. No? So that's part of the ethic and the disturb, the yardstick. No? I'm trying to love you. What's the repercussion in me? It's helping me or I'm getting? So then how loving that is for me and how loving that is for you, actually. Because if it's harming me, probably it's not so loving to you either. If my love to you is harming me, probably it's also not so loving to you. Real love will be loving in every direction, right? So we have to apply discernment to see what shape love takes so it's loving for everyone, right? Yeah.
Thank you.
It takes time. It takes introspection, vigilance. Yeah, yeah. That is worth doing it. Okay. Something else before concluding? Yes.
Just what you were just saying. I just wondered how you see that in that love, you know, how it being a negative thing. If, you know, like when it, with our examples of our predecessors, like Haridasa Kaur, or how even Yudhisthira Maharshal, they gave and they just were abused in such ways, like Haridas was beaten and fought in marketplaces. And I mean, if you're practicing tolerance or not being,
I think I get the point. Yeah, we'll try to. I'll say something, but next class, my plan is to go in detail there. But of course,
I'm not too clear on the question.
Sorry again,
I'm not too clear on the question.
Okay, if I understood correctly, what you were asking was, okay, we are speaking about, okay, being loving to others, but to ourselves as well. But in some cases, we see like someone like Haridas Thakur was chastised in a way that he was loving to everyone, but it doesn't seem that the love term came back to him. So what to do with that? Something like that?
So it wasn't beneficial to the other person.
Well, of course, as you may imagine, the first thing I will say is we are not Haridas Thakur. And I'm saying this, why? Because Haridas Thakur, though he was chastised, that section of Haridas Thakur is very much Jesus-like in many aspects, to be honest. And he responds with increased compassion to them, right? And like Jesus, he's crucified and he's like praying for those who are crucifying him. Please, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Now the thing is, who is able to say that? Who has the realization to remain compassionate in that situation and increase their love while being killed, basically? So my point is, if we are not there, again, we have to establish our adhikar and act accordingly in the way that is healthy for us. So probably for most of us, we are not invited to imitate Haridas Thakur. Right, so we are not, the idea is not to imitate anyone. The idea is to anukar and anusar, we have in Sanskrit. Anukar means imitation, anukar, kar means to do, and anu means to do what the other one is doing, to follow the doing of, and anusar, sar means essence. So anusar means to follow the essence of what the other person is doing, which means someone may be doing something again. Jesus praying on the cross with compassion. I cannot imitate that, probably, but I can follow the essence of that. Okay, compassion. He's seeing that the so-called enemies actually are not enemies. The enemies in our mind, those people are acting out of ignorance, out of fear, who knows what. So I can get those lessons and follow the essence of that and apply it in my life according to my present capabilities. So it's sustainable for me. So I keep learning my lesson instead of being overwhelmed by being on the cross. That would maybe too much for me to. So Haridas Thakur was beaten in those markets, but of course it was not beneficial for him. But we could say it's beneficial in the sense that he kept increasing his dependence on Krishna, his love for the chastiser. He had that adhikar, he had that capacity. And as we know very beautifully also in that section, Then after that Lila, Mahaprabhu is showing his associates that the lashings that Haridas Thakur received, he himself received them. So that's a very interesting point as well, how God is so close to us in those moments. He makes himself so present to us in our lives. So again, we are not Haridas Thakur. So we have to not rush and try to imitate him, but just with whatever is coming already to our lives. Okay, how to learn from this? Because whatever comes to my life, it's coming for some reason. It's not that, okay, this challenge is too much for me, this shouldn't be coming. If it's coming, it has a purpose, right? Sometimes we may not be able to draw the purpose, and that's where it's not beneficial, and that's important to the importance of being close to other people that may help us to see, okay, what can I learn from this situation in a healthy way? No, not like making myself a doormat, not like being abused, and not like entering into a situation where this is too much for me, that I'm overwhelmed, but keep it sustainable. I don't know if that helps. Sure. Something else you would like to ask or add to that, or?
Yeah, I think I'm also just thinking about all the nuances that you want to bring up.
No problem. So I just, yeah, no problem. Yeah, kind of,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Do we have time? Are we okay? Are we sort of just going, or is it?
I'm just wondering. As I like, eternity is on our side. So no problem. Yeah, I don't want to abuse. Maybe your question. We can put the discussion to rest. Yeah, and of course, if there are more questions in the evening, those who will come, we have full Q&A. So, but yeah.
Just a few thoughts following on from what some of you were saying about the, and then your response about the suffering and not pretending that we're not suffering.
Mm.
And sort of exposing that. I'm thinking about what you wrote in Radical Personalism about, because exposing my suffering, you know, allowing people to see that I'm suffering is vulnerable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about having a committed, can't remember the exact words, but like a sort of, what I understood was like a sort of safe space to expose my tender underbelly, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Because like my experience is, unless, you know, as Rupa Goswami says, exchanging confidence, isn't it? You know, that's exchange.
Yeah.
Often people can't receive my suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of like, I'll just pat you down, reassure you. And I'll say, I know you're not suffering, or it doesn't, you know, or no, you're, you know what I mean? There's all these sort of blocks to that. So it's not always easy to share my suffering, so then it's rather just not, because I don't want someone to give me advice or you know what I'm saying.
Yes,
that there's a sort of way of receiving someone's suffering,
yes,
so that they, so that it's acknowledging it, and
totally agree. Totally agree. And I never use the word easy in speaking about this, because it's not easy to do it or to find who can receive me. I never use the word impossible either. So we shouldn't lose hope and say it's not possible. It's easier to just keep the whole thing with me. It doesn't work. but yeah, I agree that we shouldn't expose our vulnerability to anyone and everyone. That has to be done with criteria and sensitivity, and it has to be with someone that we really, not only we really trust and we know, okay, there's good intention, but as you said, there has to be some skills. Not necessarily you have to be a professional psychologist or anything, but you have to be a good receiver. You have to be knowing how to listen, as you say, without feeling like tempted to preach to you advice, telling what to do, criticizing, but just listen. As simple as it is, as difficult as it is. and receive without judging, of course, and just allowing that disclosure, vulnerable disclosure, which is a very delicate moment because you are basically becoming naked in front of the other person, right? Internally. So it's very vulnerable, very fragile, very raw. So it's scary many times. What to speak if we come from past experiences where we have been abused in moments of vulnerability. So there is something that every time I'm starting to get naked, so to say, I'm triggered because it takes me to that trauma or whatever. So it's a gradual process for us to open and for the other person to receive our opening. And it's the listener cannot even demand, like, come on, open more, be fully transparent. It's a process. It's a gradual process. It may take lifetimes even in some cases, but it's okay. There is no rush. We are already in the process. But I agree that there has to be some skilled, empathic, I would say, by skill, empathic listener, receiver, that understand that sometimes you just have to listen. Sometimes what the other person needs is feeling seen, validated, received, accepted, loved. Maybe in that particular exchange, the person doesn't need to receive one single word from you. And it's fine. We have to have that type of sensitivity. Maybe that person just needs to be fully received, fully listened, fully accepted, validated, unconditionally. Mm-hmm. Unconditional positive regard. No? That's one expression also used. And I know that it's not easy. It's not that you just go around the corner and you just find everywhere is capable of, but we all need that. We all need to share. Of course, Krishna is always there in one sense, but also I won't limit it. Just reveal your mind to Krishna and that's it. We also need this human sadhaka connection. And Rupa Goswami says that's a pretty lakshanam. That's a way of showing love for one another. And it may take time till we find someone. It may be just one person. We don't need to have 108 available. If you can get one person and you can really be totally honest with, that's worthy of celebrating, right? So, but we need that. We need those people, those safe circles of vulnerability and empowerment, as I like to. When we can be vulnerable with those people in that way, that translates into empowerment. Because you are loved, you are accepted, you are understood, you are received. You are part. You are not alone in that. So there's no magical formula that, okay, press this button and you got it. It's part of our own journey also. Okay, I understand I need that. Okay, I will pray for that. I will be honest about it. I will open myself to that. Also, I won't over-idealize how that should happen. Maybe the person who is receiving me is not utterly perfect, but you can see that there are some skills and capacity, some sincerity, and I'm not perfect in disclosing my heart either, so I cannot demand. But there has to be some level of so the transaction is fruitful, so to say. And maybe the two of them continue to grow and learn in the process of sharing their hearts with one another. I certainly can see that in myself, looking back to the first times I revealed my mind or someone revealed their minds to me, and 25 years after, it's like, okay, I'm in a very different place, both when revealing my heart, both when receiving other people's heart. And I'm sure if in 25 years more, it will be continue to refine. So it's endless process. So my point is, we cannot wait for everything to be perfect to do it, because that will never happen. But also we shouldn't rush and do it in a very irrational way without any consideration, because that can end up in even feeling abused. So it has to be some middle point. Yeah. And trying and disclosing a little bit and seeing how the other person replies. Okay, it works. I'll disclose a little bit more. In sustainable installments, no, because it still feels risky, probably, but at least it shouldn't feel extremely risky that I become like paralyzed and like overwhelmed and I cannot do anything. So, yeah, it will feel risky, but we need to take some of those steps as well.
Yeah,
be vulnerable is equal to being courageous, actually. So, yeah. What do you think?
Yeah. That's appreciate it. Your response. Helpful.
Okay. Appreciate balanced. It. Yeah. Again, I'm not saying it's easy. As I like to say, just to conclude, not easy, not impossible. I like to say the opposite of easy is impossible, not difficult. Mm-hmm. Difficult is the middle point between easy and impossible. So the middle point is always difficult, but difficult doesn't mean impossible. So, yeah. Okay, we can put the discussion to rest. We can continue on this topic in 2 days, in the morning in 2 days, but today later we'll have space for whatever topics or inquiries, and we continue sharing in Atrivikram's and Sumukhi's place. So thank you so much to all of you for your time, presence, attention. Shri Gaur Nitai ki jai, Shri Prabhupada ki jai, Shri Shri Guru Parampara ki jai, Shri Shikshastakam ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Premananda, Jai Vancha Kalpataru Vishra, Kipavsan Dupi Ayi Vacha, Tita Anampa Vanepyo, Vaishnavepyo Namo, Nanta Koti Vaishnavrinda ki jai, Gaur Haribo.